Hello and welcome to the BizNews Breakfast Briefing. First off on the show today, we have Alec Hogg with an update on the markets, followed by Michael Apple covering an astonishing story where the ANC find themselves under threat of liquidation if they don't pay just over 100 million rand to KwaZulu-Natal businessman Rinesh Ramdas. In this interview, Michael speaks with Shafiq Sali, the attorney representing Ramdas and his company Ezulweni, regarding their claim against the party for failure to pay for services rendered. After that, we have Alec Hogg speaking with an airline industry veteran and co-founder of Lyft Airlines, Gidon Novik. And in this exclusive excerpt of the interview, we get a glimpse of Gidon's view of the future of the South African aviation industry. And last up, we have the global news update from our partners, the Financial Times of London. Thank you for joining us today. And now it's over to Alec with the markets.
I wish I had better news for you, but unfortunately not so. Thank you, Lucy, for that introduction. We've got quite a show coming up for you this morning in the BizNews Breakfast Briefing. But the big news as far as the markets are concerned is that we had another down day yesterday, the S&P 500 losing just under 1%. Now, this is relevant. It was the final day of the first half of 2022, and it took the first 6 months' performance to minus 21%. Only in 1970 was that figure matched. So we are at the lowest point for a half year for the American stock markets, which set the trend for everywhere else in the world since, 52 years ago. Extraordinary. The declines last night were pretty reflective of what we've seen in markets over the past 6 months, highly volatile. The major shares, some of those that we really like, Amazon down 2.5%, Apple 1.8%, Microsoft 1.3%. There was nothing spared, with some of our favorites down by 4%, Spotify, Uber, Cloudflare. And it seems to be continuing in the Far East this morning, where Tencent, which is a stock that South Africans are interested in because of the involvement there of ProSus and Naspers, Tencent is down by 3%. The JSE yesterday followed international markets lower, in fact, did even worse than Wall Street. The all-share index here down by 2.25%, primarily because of a knock from the resources shares. Thungela, one of the great stocks of the past couple of years. You might recall this is the coal operation from Anglo American. It was hived off into a separate listing. It's gone up 10 times from the level at which it was listed, but some of that glitter was taken off it yesterday when the share price was down 6.5%, the biggest loser of the major shares on the JSE. Also in the resources sector, Anglo American itself was down by 5%, Exxaro down by 5%. Amongst the others, though, there were also some hefty losses. Sanlam, 5% lower. Omnia, 6% lower. Italtile, again, one of the favorites that for long-term investors, a great performing company, this one, that was down by 6%. And the property group Hyprop was down by 5%. On the other end of the scale, you really had to scratch hard to find anything that had done well. Naspers was up by 1%. I guess that, again, more reassessment, more views amongst the investment community about what Monday's big announcement is going to mean, and that gave Naspers a little bit of a push. So nothing much really of excitement on the JSE, excepting if you happen to be short of those shares. Just going back to why stock markets have come down so sharply in the first 6 months of the year, the first reason for this is that they went up very sharply or very strongly in the previous 2 years. The second reason is that many of the investment insiders thought that inflation, which suddenly started to rise towards the end of last year and early this year, was going to be transitory. In other words, that it was caused by supply chain disruptions coming from COVID and particularly more recently from China, and that these would work their way out of the system pretty quickly. That view now seems to have changed. Certainly Mr. Market believes differently, And the worry now is that inflation can only be tamed by higher interest rates. Higher interest rates are then going to impact the economy, and as a consequence of that, there's going to be a recession. Deutsche Bank released a survey yesterday where it showed that 90% of investors in America believe that the U.S. will enter a recession before 2023, and three-quarters of those polled expect there will be further losses in share prices before the market bottoms out. Before I go, a quick reminder that our A-plus show, where my colleague Michael Apple and I look back at the news events of the past week and provide some perspective, that's now available. We recorded it last night. You can pick that up on the BizNews TV channel on YouTube or the BizNews radio channel on Spotify or iTunes. And indeed, the BizNews breakfast briefing is also available on Spotify and iTunes.
Next up, we have Michael Apple speaking with Shafiq Salih. Please do note, though, that at the time of this interview, yesterday afternoon, the ANC had not yet indicated that it will be appealing to the Supreme Court on the matter. Please enjoy.
I'm Michael Apple for BizNews.com. I'm joined by attorney Shafiq Salih. Mr. Salih, thank you for your time. Ezulweni Ranash Ramdas is your client. What is his claim against the African National Congress? Give us the background.
Morning, Mike, to you and the listeners. The claim against the ANC is in an amount of 102,465,000 rand. It's for 30,000 PVC banners that were supplied and manufactured together with a framework and installed for the ANC just prior to the May 2019 general elections.
And the 30,000 PVC banners, the company Ezulweni had to employ literally teams of people, hundreds of people, and was reliant on the ANC to pay that bill. Yeah. You have gone to court. The ANC won't pay up.
Absolutely. Mike, pursuant to the successful delivery of the service, the client did the invoice. Nothing was forthcoming from the ANC. They kept mum. They never committed to any payment plan. And they were forced then to institute action in the local High Court, Johannesburg. And of course, they were granted judgment after it was vigorously opposed by the ANC on the 17th of September 2020. The High Court judge granted judgment in the amount of 102,465,000,000 and interest from the date that the debt was due, namely 9th of May 2019. The interest is roughly, it's in truncated amounts, but it roughly works out to 10% per annum. And on a rough calculation, you're looking at about 850,000 rand per month. So that's what's due at this stage.
So if the ANC doesn't pay up, it's my understanding by the close of business Thursday, the 30th of June, what is going to happen?
Yes. As a courtesy, Mike, yesterday we informed the ANC's attorneys that if we were not paid by close of business today, in terms of our instructions, we would proceed to execute a writ against the assets of the ANC, and we also then reserved our rights to proceed with sequestration or liquidation proceedings against the party.
What's the attitude of the ANC? Are they trying to fob it off? I saw in their answering affidavit they said that this was a verbal agreement which doesn't hold any water.
Well, they denied the validity of the verbal agreement. They denied that the persons that were seized with dealing with the matter on their behalf prior to the elections were duly authorized. Is the judgment of the full bench pointed out yesterday, that defense was found to be implausible. And indeed, I quote the judge, Adams, Justice Adams, who delivered the judgment, far-fetched. And that has been our view from inception, that the ANC was just playing for time and procrastinating the inevitable.
The ANC, it's well known, has had its financial woes in the past, unable to pay staff and some of its debts in the past. I see some of the heavy hitters' names were attached to the letterheads, people like the head of elections, Fikile Mbalula, the treasurer general of the ANC, Paul Mashatile.
Yes.
These are not unknown names in the ANC. If you're getting a letter
absolutely.
With those names attached, you would think that your agreement is in good faith.
Absolutely. I mean, we the client has suffered dismally. You can imagine fulfilling a contract of this magnitude and not being paid since May 2019. They've almost been liquidated themselves. They've been inundated with claims by service providers. There's an army of people that they use to fulfill this contract, and we've patiently waited for judgment to finally be confirmed.
Is there any indication from the ANC that they're going to appeal this?
Well, they have the rights, but I doubt I don't believe they'll be granted leave by the full bench, one. And I believe they'll be procrastinating, as I've said, the inevitable, namely to pay the judgment debt.
Shafiq Salih, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
And now for Alex's interview with Gideon Novick.
Gideon, we're not here to talk about load shedding and the bad news. You always see the glass half full. Can you see any half full glass in the aviation industry at the moment?
Yeah, very much so, actually. People are traveling again. They're getting tired of using technology exclusively and want to see each other face to face, which is a good thing. And I mean, in Europe at the moment, it's crazy, as you know, the massive resurgence of travel. So that's a good sign. People want to connect. People want to explore the beautiful planet that we live on. And air travel is a key part of that.
Gideon, the industry itself, you have mentioned that Lyft came along 2 years ago. Had COVID not happened, would the opportunities be better or worse for your new airline? Before we get on to your other one, or your potentially your other one anyway, South African Airways, but let's just stay with Lyft for now.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have gotten back in, I don't think. I think COVID was the opportunity. It was, you know, it was a time when there was, you know, existing players were taking major strain. There were assets available at very good prices, incredible skills available in the industry that we're looking for something to do. And I had a lot of time to think. So, you know, it was just a confluence of factors and, you know, it felt to me like opportunity for some kind of an industry reset, which has played itself out, particularly over the last month or so.
Comair, take us through that story when you left and what happened subsequent to that, because if I recall correctly, there might have been a different owner to the one who owned it into bankruptcy.
Yeah, so it's got obviously a very long history, a 75-year history, the business. My dad, as I said, was involved for 50 years. I was there for about 13 years. We left together about 10 years ago. At the time, it was, there were new shareholders, Bidvest was getting involved. There was a difference. We had a difference in view on strategy in the business, and it was time to move on. I was very excited to try other things. My dad was getting on in years and, you know, wanted to spend more time with family. So, you know, it was a fortunate time to leave the business. And I was actually happy to be out of the industry. It was, it's a draining industry and incredibly interesting and challenging and exciting, but it's draining. So I was happy to be out. And then COVID came along and just the opportunity was too tempting to pass on.
With Comair?
Yeah, I mean, the opportunity in the industry, given what was happening with Comair, you know, they had gone into business rescue. Prior to that, you know, they'd been under, you know, enormous pressure for a long time before COVID. Many, many factors. I mean, it's probably, you know, a few hours of conversation and maybe some subjective views of things that went wrong and things that could have done better. I think with anything there's bad luck that comes your way as well as good luck. And then there's decisions that are made along the journey that in my view at the end of the day determine whether your likelihood of success is good or not. So yeah, so that was a long story. I don't know which part of it you want to chat about, but you know there was a, you know, that company was in trouble long before COVID.
But when the new shareholders came in out of business rescue, or at least the attempt which appeared as though Comair could get back on its feet. There appeared to be other bidders as well at that time.
Yeah, I think there were two bidders. I think Harith was one of them. Harith is the partner in the Takatsa Consortium on SAA. And then there was the Rescue, I think they called themselves the Rescue Consortium, who ended up taking ownership of the business.
And Harith is your partner in the new South African Airways.
Yeah.
So they might have ended up with Comair had the cards been dealt differently then.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, as you know, well aware, that's still got some way to go in terms of the process, the agreement, a lot of conditions precedent. So, you know, in my view, that's still quite a journey, the SAA one. Our involvement in SAA is we are a minority shareholder in the consortium, the Takatsa Consortium. At this stage, we're not involved in the running of SAA at all. But, we'd love to help in some way going forward, but we've got to figure all of that out. We're so busy at the moment with Lyft and the opportunities that are being presented in the market that it's taking, just about all of our focus.
Just before we move off South African Airways, it does appear to be an enormous challenge if you and the Harith team, in other words, the Takatsa Consortium, are to take it over. You've been presented as the new chief executive. But talking with Miles van der Molen of SEME this week, he was telling us that they move more passengers than SAA today with half the staff or under half the staff, which sounds to me like South African Airways will be a real mountain for whomever, and particularly for the chief executive yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm not. Yeah, I mean, I haven't put my hand up to run it. I actually don't think I'd be the best person to run it, regardless. But as minority shareholders, we're happy to help and happy to see how we could get more involved if it makes sense to. But as you say, it's very difficult to recalibrate an existing operation that's inefficient. It's much easier, as we did with Lyft, to start with a clean sheet in every respect. From an efficiency perspective, to build, the right cost base from the start, from a people perspective, to make sure that everybody that comes on board are the right people. And then probably most importantly, from a culture point of view, just to really set that culture from the start. And technology, by the way, legacy systems are very difficult to re-engineer. And technology is moving so fast that it really is easier to come in later and just leapfrog from a technology point of view.
So South African Airways is not a done deal by any means at this point?
Well, the deal's been signed and there's conditions precedent. I know there's a process going through the Competitions Commission. Harith are running with that. That's their responsibility. And as you know, the operation is up and running. So, which I think makes it, quite difficult as well, as opposed to coming into something that's being restarted. SAA is up and running, but as Miles correctly says, it's a fairly small operation. And there would be a mountain of work to do, absolutely.
What about insurance against airlines going bankrupt? It's not a theoretical question anymore.
Yeah, it's such an important point, Alec. This South Africans have really, if you look at the stats, it's close to about 10 airlines in the last 10 years have either gone bankrupt or gone into business rescue or, disappeared in some way. And so, people have just been left high and dry. Some have been able to claim back their ticket through their banks, their credit cards. But what we think is necessary is actually legislation that would require any prepaid ticket, and as you know, tickets are bought in advance of you actually traveling, should be protected. That should be in some kind of an escrow structure where if something happens to that airline, those passengers get their money back straight away. So we will be, working with the regulators to try and convince them that that's an important part of the industry. Because at the end of the day, what the industry needs is strong, sustainable competitors. You need players that passengers can trust are going to be around, And if they screw up their business in some way, they, you know, they are not funders of the business. They've just bought a ticket to travel to visit their relative somewhere in the country. They shouldn't be funding the cash flow of airlines.
I guess the surprise is that that isn't already law. It seems rather strange if you're paying for something up front and something happens to that company that you won't get your money back. But Gideon, how are you seeing this evolving, the airline industry in South Africa evolving in the years ahead?
Yeah, you know, South Africa's, it's not the best place to have an airline. You know, geographically, we kind of on the southern tip of Africa. So if you compare us to, you know, for example, Ethiopia, which is, you know, very well placed, not only on the African continent, but almost on an east-west basis, is able to connect many points and many destinations. So we're quite limited down here. We have quite a robust market. I mean, in rand terms, the domestic market post-COVID will be worth about 20 billion rand. So it's a decent market, but you know, the growth has to be up north. You know, not only in terms of services into continental Africa and destinations to our north, but also, you know, the skills and the infrastructure. Our one of our core beliefs is that, you know, South Africa is incredibly, you know, has the resources, has the skills, has the infrastructure in many industries, aviation being one of them, and we can serve the continent with those capabilities. So our aspiration is to build a very strong, high quality, doesn't have to be massive in scale, but has to be, you know, the highest quality that we can achieve, and to export those skills into the continent to build a viable, sustainable aviation sector, which, as you know, was massively impacted by COVID. And outside of a handful of airlines, you know, Ethiopian being the most impressive, there's very few, you know, sustainable, competent airlines on the continent.
And lastly, it's over to the Financial Times for today's global news update.
Good morning from the Financial Times. Today is Friday, July 1st, and this is your FT News Briefing. China's middle class is fed up with COVID lockdowns, and many are searching for a way out. And on Wall Street, things just keep getting worse.
It's been an absolute stinker of a first half of the year. Somehow, we're already halfway through 2022. And it's just been horrendous.
We'll hear more from our markets editor, Katie Martin. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday reined in regulators' ability to reduce carbon emissions. I'm Jess Smith, in for Mark Filippino. And here's the news you need to start your day. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday dealt a blow to President Joe Biden's plans to fight climate change. The court ruled that the country's top environmental regulator, the EPA, was not authorized by Congress to reduce carbon emissions when the agency was first set up in 1970. The decision limits the EPA's power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. The suit was brought by a host of Republican states and the coal industry. In the dissenting opinion, liberal justices argued that the EPA does have the authority to regulate stationary sources of pollutants that are harmful to the public, and that includes greenhouse gases. Investors have been fleeing the world's biggest equities market as U.S. central bankers raise interest rates and as worries about global growth continue to mount. This year, U.S. stocks have shed about $9 trillion in value. Here's the FT's Katie Martin.
It's an enormous amount of money. It's more than I get paid in a year. I dare say it's even more than you get paid in a year. The S&P 500, it's down 20% or so far this year. It's had the worst first half of the year of any year since 1970. It's just been abysmal.
Katie's our markets editor, and she joins me to talk more about this abysmal year. Hi, Katie.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. So what's going on here? Is it largely a reaction to rising interest rates?
It's certainly the biggest issue for investors and for stocks. So, you know, there are large parts of the stock market where there are companies whose valuations really hinge on low interest rates. And for investors to look at not necessarily companies that make money today, but companies that will make money in future. That only works really if inflation is really low and if interest rates are really low. That is absolutely no longer true. You know, that sort of changes the equation for a lot of companies out there financially. Central bankers, one of the things they've been doing this week, there's been a get together in Portugal. They've been putting their hands up and saying, okay, we have to accept that inflation doesn't work quite how we think it worked. There is no way that we can get this inflation back under control without there being some pain in the economy. But we simply have to get inflation back under control, because if we let it keep spiraling higher, then that's worse.
Are investors surprised at that, or did they have some hope that somehow the Fed could manage a painless landing?
So, you know, hope is the last thing to die. You know, there has been some hope that maybe they can come up with some magic trick that will soften the blow here, but that hope has been receding, particularly over the past month.
And Katie, are we seeing this kind of pain in other big equities markets like Europe?
Yeah, generally to a lesser extent, we're seeing it everywhere. There are some stock markets, like, for example, you look at the FTSE 100, which is more or less flat in the UK so far this year. But again, that's because of the UK's very heavy weighting towards energy stocks and commodities companies. They've been having a great ride. But so different stock markets have been affected differently depending on what the kind of makeup of those markets is. But in the US, where you do have these massive tech names, there's certainly a lot of pain. And, you know, the obvious question is, okay, are we done now? You know, this has been a historic pullback. Is it time to snap up some bargains? That's the question that investors are asking themselves. And the general vibe I'm getting, at least from people that I talk to, is, yeah, not just yet.
Katie Martin is the FT's markets editor. Thanks so much, Katie.
Pleasure.
In China, hundreds of millions of people are chafing under the government's strict COVID lockdowns. Many middle-class citizens are now starting to think about escaping. There's been a huge surge in online searches about how to emigrate. Our China correspondent, Ed White, has been reporting on this phenomenon called runshui, which roughly means the study of how to get out.
What this runshui is saying is that many, many Chinese people are sitting locked up in apartments or in suburbs in big cities across China, unable to live their normal lives. They're unable to necessarily go to work, to go to the classrooms. They're unable to get their kids out to play, all of these sorts of things that we take for granted. As the coronavirus lockdowns have kept going and going in China, and the thought that they could keep going for years ahead, that has made people think, you know what, is there a way out? Can I leave China for good? And that's where this trend has come from.
So economically speaking, how bad have things gotten for the middle class?
So if you look at the headline metrics, China is teetering on the edge of a rare quarterly recession. Growth, of course, in China has been slowing for a long time. But in reality, people's lives have kind of kept getting better. So, you know, people's jobs have improved, people's spending ability have improved. And now there's just a sense that actually going forward, things might not improve that much. The other thing that I would say is an important part of this trend and that we've just seen in recent months is that for a long time, people were blaming the local government for how the lockdowns were being implemented. There was this chaos and this something that was happening to one person in one apartment would be different in the neighboring apartment. Now what we're seeing is that the complaints that we're hearing about are far more directed at Beijing and the policy rather than the local government. And it's now affecting people in a way that's making them question the government.
Ed, do we know if people are actually leaving the country and turning this study of escaping into reality?
The middle class, feasibly, you know, if they had money in normal times when borders were open, they could maybe find a way if they were committed and made a plan over a long period of time. But at the moment, China has ruled that all unnecessary travel is not allowed. So that means that if you want to go, you can try and book a ticket. You could even try and get some visas organized and things like that. But you might find that when you get out to the airport, you're not going to be allowed on a plane. So, or at least not be allowed through customs. So it's very, very difficult.
Ed, you know, all this frustration over lockdown hasn't just led to people searching online for ways to leave the country. I mean, there have also been some small protests. Do you think all of this could lead to any change? I mean, do you think the government's taking note?
The answer is we don't really know. We don't know how much of what the ordinary people in China are talking about gets pushed up the line to Xi Jinping. However, you could say that they are making some changes, very minor. Things like trying to standardize the amount of time that one might spend in quarantine if they're a close contact or if they have the virus. Also standardizing and shortening the time for people traveling back to China from overseas. I think we can see that there are some changes taking place. How much of that is trying to appease the middle class? Not so sure, but at least it's a signal that maybe some of these messages are getting through.
Ed White is the FT's China correspondent. Before we go, the European Union yesterday struck its first free trade deal in 3 years. It's with New Zealand. The agreement gets rid of tariffs on EU exports to New Zealand, and New Zealand's meat and dairy industries will have better access to European markets. Also part of the deal, New Zealand farmers will have to stop using protected EU names like feta and Manchego cheese.
And that's all from the BizNews Breakfast Briefing for today. Thank you for joining us. And if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to like, subscribe, follow, and share.